This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Recent U.S. intelligence reports claim that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda may be further along than previously thought toward making a radiological weapon. Officials say that maximum effort is being devoted to detecting and preventing detonation of a so-called dirty bomb. Earlier today, I spoke with Peter Greer, a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked him about what U.S. intelligence services have learned about al-Qaeda's nuclear capabilities.
Reportedly, they're much more worried that al-Qaeda has the ability to produce a so-called radiological weapon, which is not, it should be stressed, a fission, sort of nuclear mushroom cloud-like explosion, which would be a terrific catastrophe. It is a more limited type of capability, which involves packing dangerous radiological material around a conventional explosive and blowing it up and disseminating that in a cloud, which causes death by radiation either immediately or over a period of time through causing cancer.
This is a so-called dirty bomb.
That's right.
And what do we know about how close they are to that capacity?
I don't think we really know. They have had a many-layered multi-year effort to acquire some sort of radiological or nuclear capability. A group with the amount of money that al-Qaeda has and with the number of adherents it has in as many nations as it has will be able to get something at some point unless we move in and stop them in some manner.
And to the point of whether they have it now, what are intelligence services saying or what are the signals they're giving?
Now what they're saying is that we have to plan for the worst-case scenario. In other words, we have lots of hints that they have acquired a limited amount of fissile material. For instance, as I led off my article with, there was the testimony in New York in the trial of the al-Qaeda operatives linked to the bombings in East Africa of U.S. embassies in 1998. There was a al-Qaeda turncoat who testified to his role in a sort of nuclear shopping spree in Khartoum, Sudan, in which he went through different layers of various mysterious contacts in his search for uranium. And eventually he was shown a tube. He didn't know necessarily what it contained because he was not a nuclear scientist, but it had various mysterious markings and the phrase South Africa, which was the only thing that he recognized.
South Africa, a nuclear power.
Well, South Africa did have a nuclear program under the apartheid regime, and they constructed six relatively simple gun-type uranium nuclear weapons. And at the time, they were under their own international embargo. So that shows how a determined organization with a relatively broad capability can acquire these weapons.
And presumably, if this one fellow in Khartoum was shopping, he's not the only person who's been shopping for al-Qaeda to find radioactive or nuclear material.
That's right. Now, that one tube, experts told me that many of the details of this man's account are consistent, in fact, with that being an actual a tube of uranium of some sort, either highly enriched uranium, which is weapons grade, or perhaps something related to a nuclear reactor's fuel rods.
Peter Greer, earlier this week there was a new national alert about possible terrorist attacks over the holidays. How likely is it then that one of these attacks could involve radioactive materials, weapons, or the targeting of a nuclear facility?
It seems to me that there are a number of things which appear to indicate that the government thinks that in fact, is what we need to guard against. Because you probably saw the story in the Washington Post by the well-known reporter Bob Woodward, who has been described sometimes as the father confessor of senior government officials, which basically said, well, you know, we are more worried than ever that Osama bin Laden has the stuff to put together a dirty bomb. And that was juxtaposed with the new warning about possible terrorist operations. I think that it is no accident that those two things came out at the same time.
What can U.S. intelligence services, military, law enforcement do to stop this effort?
Well, they've been trying to stop the effort for years. In what looks to be prescience now, Senator Richard Lugar and former Senator Sam Nunn in the early 90s pressed for extensive government action on this very issue. They began a series of programs that was originally called the Nunn-Lugar program and has since been passed through a variety of those strange government acronym names and is now called CTR, the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program. The U.S. government, in essence, pays Russia to try and control its loose nuclear material in a more secure manner, mm-hmm. To pay their scientists so they don't get on a plane and fly to Iraq, because Saddam Hussein's offering them more money in an island in the South Seas, et cetera, et cetera.
But those are big ongoing programs. It seems like maybe the thing is even packed in a duffel bag somewhere already. How do you go after that?
That's an excellent question. That's a law enforcement question that I don't think any of us really know the answer to, other than the fact of if the weapon is, in fact, a radiological weapon, it emits a lot of radioactivity even before being blown up, which means it's relatively easy to detect. And there are government search teams, for instance, that have radiological detectors that can fly over cities looking for, say, hotspots where such a weapon might be stored.
So that would turn up X-ray machines at airports and potentially bags of nuclear material, or?
Well, we're talking about something that would probably be a lot larger than you'd be loading in your carry-on bags at the mm-hmm. airport. Mm-hmm. You're talking about something that would at least be the size of a small van. If you get into the physics of a dirty bomb, actually, it would take a lot of radiological material to kill a lot of people.
Through radiation sickness, you mean?
Through radiation sickness, or just because of, you know, when you explode it, making it, these are horrible things to talk about, but dispersing the material in a manner which is efficient at killing people is, in fact, relatively difficult. Mm-hmm. It's what it would be great at, of course, is freaking out the entire nation, if not the world, mm-hmm. because it would be, quote, nuclear, unquote. And so terrorism would have been taken to a new and strange and extremely scary level.
And even if it didn't kill a lot of people, would it put an area of real estate off limits for a while? Would it contaminate
for a long time? Depending on the material, it could put an area of real estate off limits for decades.
That's something.
Cesium 137, for instance, a very material which is often fingered as something that would be used in that, has a half-life of about 30 years. So that would mean if they exploded that kind of thing in a truck bomb at 16th and K in Washington, no one would be going to downtown Washington for decades. Well, we have experience with this kind of thing. For instance, in Tokyo, the religious group Aum Shinriko mm-hmm. carried out nerve gas attacks in the Tokyo subway. Now, they weren't really that – they didn't kill very many people, but they terrified the entire city of Tokyo. When they threatened to do it again, the entire city shut down. No one went in, no one went out, and the entire police force mobilized.
With terrorism, it doesn't actually have to work with full effectiveness in order to be effective. And if it did work, well, horrible to contemplate.
Right.
Peter Greer is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with me earlier today from Washington. For years, Osama bin Laden has said he was working to obtain nuclear capability. Does he finally have it? If so, what can U.S. intelligence do to prevent it from being used? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Matthew Bunn joins us now. He's Assistant Director of the Science, Technology, and Public Policy Program at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. From 1994 to 1996, he advised the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy on issues of security and monitoring of nuclear weapons. Good evening, Matthew Bunn. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
So it's gone from hypothetical to maybe an urgent issue. We don't know. There are disclaimers all over this reporting, and yet the reporting is out there that the government believes with that there's greater reason to fear now than ever, perhaps, that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda or some group of terrorists have some kind of nuclear weapon. There's no public record that any country or terrorist group has detonated a radiological bomb, but the threat of nuclear terrorism appears more real now than ever before. Why?
Well, it's clear that Osama bin Laden has been attempting to get both the materials you would need for a real nuclear bomb and the kind of materials for this much less devastating dirty bomb concept for a number of years. And unfortunately, those kinds of materials, both the kinds of materials you need for a nuclear bomb and even more so the radiological materials, are all over the world in a variety of forms and in some cases are dangerously insecure, so that it is now quite plausible, particularly for the radiological material, that they might have managed to get hold of such a thing.
You talk about a dirty bomb, a radiological bomb, as less devastating, but we shouldn't understate what its impact might be. What could the impact of a dirty bomb be on an urban area, let's say?
Well, it really depends on what kind of material they have, how much of it they have, and how they disperse it. But in general, the experience that we have, and unfortunately we do have some experience with accidentally explosively dispersing, for example, plutonium.
Is that Chernobyl that you mean? Or?
No. For example, over Spain, over Palomares, Spain in the 1960s, two of our aircraft, a bomber and a tanker aircraft, collided. The bomber dropped several of its bombs, and one of them, the conventional explosives, exploded, spread plutonium over an area of several square kilometers. Nobody died immediately. It's likely that one or two people died of cancer against the large background of people dying of cancer over the intervening years. That area, although plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years, that area was, in fact, cleaned up. They basically carried away the top 10 inches or so of dirt from those areas that were most heavily contaminated. The less heavily contaminated areas, they just plowed it under. The bottom line is that a dirty bomb is really a weapon of mass fear, mass disruption. It's not a weapon of mass death.
What's a likely target? If terrorists did have a dirty bomb, where would they most want to put it to explode it?
Presumably somewhere in a city. And what you would do is you would take some radiological material, you would put it together with some conventional explosives, you would set it off in such a way as to disperse that radiological material around.
Help us visualize that. How much radiological material and how much conventional explosive? Are we talking about a picnic basket full or a truckload or something else?
It depends on what the terrorist wants to do. It might be as little, probably not as little as a picnic basket full, but it might well be, you know, a large duffel bag full of explosive with potentially a relatively small amount of radiological material, potentially a couple of pounds, even less, of the radiological material. Now, again, that wouldn't result in killing a lot of people, but what you would have is you'd have this announcement, oh, my goodness, there's radiation spewing out from this bomb. Everybody leave, and there'd be the very word nuclear provokes such fear. There'd be panic. People would have to leave, and then you'd have a very expensive cleanup problem on your hands.
But Peter Greer was talking about potentially clearing out an urban area for years or decades. Is that conceivable?
I don't think that's likely, because I think that it would be possible to clean up, but cleanup is not easy. You could end up with particles that were very small, that were relatively hard to find.
And we've seen single office buildings now closed down for months by a couple of spores of anthrax. Can you see a downtown shut down for months, years?
Yes.
I mean, the impact of that on any local economy could be utterly devastating.
Could be devastating, absolutely. If you imagine, for example, that one of the planes on September 11, in addition to crashing into the World Trade Center, had on it a few pounds of, say, cesium-137, which is one of the more nasty but one of the more common isotopes, you would have had to evacuate a larger area. You wouldn't have been able to send in the rescuers and the firefighters except with their moon suits on. You would have had an incredibly expensive cleanup operation.
Wall Street would not be back up and operating.
Wall Street would not be back up and operating. That's exactly right. And so the potential for disruption is very great. The potential for terror is very great. But I don't want to exaggerate the potential for deaths. Not very many people would die. Most of the people who would die in such an event would be killed by the explosives that were dispersing the radiation, not by the radiation itself.
We're anxious to see it like it really is tonight. But the temperature has been raised on this. Peter Greer mentioned the Bob Woodward article. Of course, Bob Woodward is often seen as kind of leaking things that highly placed government officials want the country to know.
Absolutely. This is a threat. It's something we need to be working on. It strikes me that there are several things we need to be doing immediately.
We've got a quick break that we've got to take. Let's come back and look at those. We're looking tonight at the threat of a dirty bomb. It's been hypothetical for a long time. Now it may be more real. Are you prepared to see the nuclear threat, or is it just too much to contemplate? How would a radioactive downtown affect the nation's psyche, its economy, its will to fight? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or get into the conversation online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back.
From Boston University, this is WBUR.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the threat of the dirty bomb. It may be more real than even our nightmares suggested. The word coming out of Washington is that concern is high, that the warnings may even be linked to Tom Ridge's concern that or warning of new threats in the holiday season. A dirty bomb would not be a nuclear explosion, but could leave a lot of dangerous radioactivity over an urban area for a long, long time. We're talking tonight with Matthew Bunn. He's assistant director of the Science, Technology, and Public Policy program at the Kennedy School at Harvard, and for a couple of years in the mid-90s was central or at the heart of the U.S. government's efforts to track and monitor nuclear materials. You can join the conversation, too. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Are you confident in the security of nuclear waste worldwide? How can we stop a dirty bomb? Matthew Bunn, I want to put that to you. Let's just assume for the moment, because it seems that it would be irresponsible not to, that maybe, in fact, they do have it, that the materials are there, that they may even have been combined with conventional explosives that could disperse them over a broad area. What now? What do we do?
Well, I think the first thing we need to be doing is what we're doing already, that is trying to stomp out al-Qaeda, both in Afghanistan and in its various cells around the world. I think that they're really a very small fraction of all the terrorist groups out there that would have any interest in this kind of thing. Most terrorist groups, as the famous saying goes, want a lot of people watching, not a lot of people dead. They don't want to do things that are too extreme because they actually want to maintain political support for whatever their political objective is. It's really only the apocalyptic groups like al-Qaeda, like the Japanese terror cult Aum Shinrikyo, that you have to worry about, particularly when you're thinking about nuclear weapons, when you're thinking about radiological bombs.
And yet it's al-Qaeda, of course, that we are
al-Qaeda,
concerned about
of course,
this season.
That we're worried about.
And
exactly.
Apocalyptic terrorism is the flavor of the month.
Exactly. So we need to stomp out those groups that have that characteristic.
Let's look at that first. How much difference does it make to really put the heat on these groups in Afghanistan? Does that matter, or is it so globally dispersed that that's irrelevant?
It definitely matters. If you can destroy the main cells of the group of the very few groups that would be interested in this kind of attack, I think you can greatly reduce the probability of this kind of attack being carried out.
From your work and study, do you have the sense that Afghanistan was in fact a kind of nuclear laboratory for al-Qaeda? We know that the CIA found materials about building dirty bombs and nuclear weaponry in the ruins of Taliban structures in Kabul and elsewhere. But was it a lab or is it just a headquarters?
I don't think we know enough to know the answer to that question yet. I think it was mainly just a headquarters. It appears that their efforts to get nuclear material and nuclear explosives were, while energetic and well-funded, were often confused and not extremely well implemented. The person that Peter mentioned who was attempting to buy the enriched uranium in Sudan clearly had absolutely no idea what he was doing, and it appears the people he was reporting to had no idea what they were doing. It appears also that al-Qaeda has been scammed on more than one occasion by people selling them basically trash that they claimed was nuclear weapons material.
But there was enough money there to be scammed a bunch of times and keep on going. We do have these warnings from the government. We have even a senior official in the White House being quoted by Bob Woodward as saying that one of the key reasons that Dick Cheney is not going to the White House, even to meet important foreign leaders, is the fear that it could be end up in the zone of a radiological weapon and that both the president and vice president could not be in that zone. So let's assume that the government has some reason to fear that just stomping on Afghanistan is not necessarily going to catch
this.
If it's out there in the world, what do we do? How do you go after it? How do you find it?
That's by stomping on al-Qaeda is by no means the only thing we ought to be doing. Secondly, we need to not assume that they have all of the radiological material that they would want. We need to be moving as quickly as we can to secure and account for all the nuclear weapons, the nuclear weapons material, and also at least the large sources of radiological material that are around the world. There's a lot more that we can be doing, should be doing, to get that job done as fast as humanly possible.
And we've heard you talk about that, but that's really programmatic. That means systematically locking down the Soviet, ex-Soviet facilities and others where more material could emerge.
That's exactly right. Thirdly, perhaps, we need to be doing a better job both at borders where this material is getting smuggled across in Central Asia, for example, in Eastern Europe, but also at our own borders. There are 100 million or so trucks that cross our borders every year. There are millions of cargo containers.
How do we deal with that flow of material?
Well, I think there is a lot more that we can do about increasing the pace and scale of inspections. In New York Harbor, for example, they are already inspecting a much larger fraction of the cargo containers coming in on ships.
We're talking about maybe one duffel bag. Is there technology that can be put to work to help in that?
Absolutely. As Peter Greer was mentioning, an intense radiological source, as would be the material for a radiological bomb, can typically be detected from some distance by radiation detectors. Now, it depends, of course, on how much shielding the terrorists have put around it. If you have it in a thick lead box, it makes it a lot harder to detect. But nonetheless, in most cases, you're going to be able to see some traces of radiation from such a thing if you're doing the inspections that you need to be doing. And in some cases, it would start making sense to start moving the inspections back from our own borders. Let's start reaching agreements with countries to inspect the ships before they leave, not after the cargo container is unloaded in our harbor. Because if it's a nuclear bomb,
as opposed to a
dirty bomb, you can set it off while it's still on the ship before it ever gets unloaded, before the inspection ever takes place.
And how about this notion of just flying over and beaming down? Can we actually spot something deep in a container ship by flying over and pointing the detector at it?
If it's not very well shielded, yes. If it is well shielded, probably not.
Matthew Bunn, we have callers who want to join this conversation. We're talking about the dirty bomb. The threat, Washington says, is greater than ever. Do you believe the dirty bomb threat is real, or are we telling ourselves ghost stories here? What measures are you prepared to see taken to stop the detonation of a dirty bomb? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Irene is on the line. Welcome, Irene. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm going to raise several points because I went through this with other scientists at the time of the Gulf War, and I'd like to remind the people that are in policy decisions of all the possibilities.
Okay, first of all,
we have to remember Osama bin Laden is a very smart terrorist. He knows how to go through the thinking of taking extremely simple tools and maximize the kill.
So what should we take from that?
Okay, no, you start from there, okay? So the next thing you say is, okay, number one, is there a source of radioactive material that's in the U.S.? The answer is yes, of course. We have massive numbers of reactors, and there are tons and tons and tons of spent fuel.
So you're, you're talking about nuclear power facilities.
Yeah, yeah. I'm talking about stuff that's in the country that never has to go through customs and that should be under security, but if you have enough money, it might not be.
And if it's not, it's just kind of a passively waiting dirty bomb in the making.
It's sitting there. That's right. Now, the one thing about spent nuclear waste is that it is sometimes more radioactive after it comes out of the reactor than before. And it's got some of those extremely long-lived isotopes that have two specific properties. One is that their half-life is very long, so they persist wherever the heck they are for a long time. Mm-hmm. And number two, the last thing that you have to remember about whatever source of nuclear material is that if it's an alpha emitter and it ends up in the lungs, it will kill you of lung cancer. It's extremely difficult to detect because even a sheet of paper will bar an alpha particle from a monitor of any kind. But if it's dispersed as dust from a crop duster, which those guys were learning to fly, we have a scenario of an extremely toxic material. They know how to disperse it, and whether they die in the attempt or not doesn't matter to them.
Irene, it's great. I want to get Matthew Bunn's response. Is there another point you wanted to make before I
think we need to be looking at a lot more options from the angle of what's the easiest way to get to each step?
You're saying the hot duffel bag is too easy to think about, and there are actually much more potentially dangerous.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And less detectable methods.
Matthew Bunn, how about this? Do you see, what are the alternate methods that might be much more menacing that the raw materials are just lying around for, i.e. maybe nuclear power plants, and is the government taking those threats seriously?
Well, I think nuclear power plants are a particularly important hazard to be looking at because when you're talking about a dirty bomb, a duffel bag filled with explosives and some radiological material, we're talking at most perhaps a few pounds, a few tens of pounds at most of radiological material. In a nuclear reactor, you've got tens of tons of intensely radioactive material. Now, that reactor has redundant safety systems. It has a thick containment, concrete containment vessel around it.
So how could it be turned into a weapon?
And it has a security force. But those security forces would have a difficult time dealing with a threat as big as what we saw on September 11. That is, four teams of well-trained people who'd been planning for over a year, independent, well-coordinated, striking without warning, suicidal. That's a big threat, and that's why Governor Ridge has suggested that each governor of a state that has a nuclear power plant or a spent fuel facility call out the National Guard to help protect that nuclear reactor. Unfortunately, many of the governors have not yet done so.
But I want to be sure we understand what you're suggesting here. There has been some speculation since September 11th that, in fact, one of those planes was intended to go into a nuclear power plant. Would that set off the kind of problem we're describing here tonight?
No one knows for sure, but those few calculations that have been done suggest that it's at least possible that the huge engines from a big commercial airliner, you know, traveling at a reasonable speed would, in fact, smash through the concrete containment vessel. The fuel might cause an explosion inside that vessel that then could potentially set in motion the chain of events that would lead to a meltdown and a Chernobyl-type accident. Similarly, if you attack a pool containing spent fuel from a nuclear reactor, which are often not within the containment vessel, sometimes they are within, but sometimes they're out of it, if you can drain all of the water out of that pool in a way that the emergency systems can't replace it, then the fuel will overheat. And if it gets hot enough, then the zirconium can catch fire. The fire then lifts that radiological material into the air, spreads it over the surrounding countryside. Either of those scenarios, the nuclear reactor or the spent fuel pool, are much, much more devastating than a dirty bomb. A dirty bomb, you're talking about a few blocks that you have an expensive cleanup problem on your hands and you have a lot of panic. With a nuclear reactor, you're talking about an area the size of Pennsylvania that you might have to basically abandon.
Good Lord. And might Pennsylvania include cities, we note.
Indeed.
That's breathtaking. I have a small semantic question, minute in comparison, but you're calling this a radiological weapon. We use the word radioactive in popular parlance. Is it the same thing, or is there a difference?
It's basically the same thing. In saying radiological, you mean that it's intended to cause people to ingest the radioactivity.
We're trying to get our heads around the notion of an attack using a nuclear power plant, as Irene suggested. And Irene, thank you for your call, that might require emptying an area the size of Pennsylvania. How can we stop a dirty bomb? How can we stop a dirty bomb that's really just sitting there already as a nuclear power plant? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Kelly is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Kelly.
How you doing tonight, gentlemen?
We're well, thank you.
Good deal. I just got a couple of comments and picked up listening to your show there.
Yeah.
I think it's a good idea to hear people talk about these kind of things and make people aware of what's going on. And like Ms. Irene said, you know, the policymakers let them know that there are different scenarios out there that could or could not happen.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Matt, let me ask you a question directly. Mr. Bond, what is your gut feeling about something like this? I mean, if it's here already, I mean, there's nothing that we can do about it, correct?
I don't think so. I think there's quite a number of things that we can do. I think that we can secure nuclear power plants and spent fuel facilities better. I think there's a huge amount to do to secure and neutralize the nuclear material that could be used to make actual nuclear bombs that could rip out the heart of a major city. And I think there's a lot we can do to control the easier to acquire radiological material, the radiological sources and so on. There's a large agenda of things that we can do. I believe, while it's late in the day, that we can stop nuclear terrorism if we take action now.
Matthew Bunn, also implicit in Kelly's question is, I think, asking for a gut check on how real a possibility are these things. I mean, we're talking about them seriously tonight because you can't ignore them. But do some handicapping for us. Even with these latest warnings and signals out of Washington, are we talking about a very minute possibility, a distant possibility, a real and present possibility?
I think this is a clear and present danger to the United States of America. I think that the potential for someone to use a radiological weapon is very, very real. I think the potential for attack on a nuclear power plant is very, very real. I think the potential for someone actually putting together a nuclear bomb of the kind that destroyed Hiroshima, while much less likely, is so devastating that we need to be very concerned about that. I don't believe people should be panicked, but I do believe people should be concerned.
Matthew Bunn, let's get one more call in before the break. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hello. You're on the air, John.
Okay. I had a question for your guest. If I had a kilogram of plutonium and I airbursted at maybe 5,000 feet above a city and the particle size was 5 microns, what sort of effect would you expect from that? Because I think your guest is maybe minimizing the risk here.
John, you seem to speak with some insight. Have you got a kilogram of plutonium? We hope not.
No, but I did used to work in nuclear medicine, so I worked with radioactive materials.
Well, then, let's put the question. Thank you, John. Matthew Bunn?
There have been a variety of studies that have been done of exactly that question, that basically,
we're talking about sort of the crop dusting of very fine particles.
Or explosive dispersal of very fine particles of plutonium. And we have, as I say, some experience with actual explosive dispersal of plutonium in a couple of unfortunate accidents. The studies that have been done suggest that what you're looking at is nobody dying immediately and an increase in cancers that, if you're only talking about a kilogram over an urban area, is probably of the order of a couple of hundred people, not of the order of thousands of people dying of cancer. There are a lot easier ways to kill a couple of hundred people than that, but the fear factor would be immense.
John, let's get your view. Does that sort of equate with what you imagine the impact would be?
No. I think it would be much more severe. I think
in terms of immediate death or long term?
Long term, the particles stick around, and once they're lodged in the lung, it's a death sentence.
John, we've got to take a break. Thank you for your call. We're talking about the dirty bomb, the possibility that it could already be among us, and we really cannot write it off as a possibility, is what we're hearing here tonight. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Are you prepared to see the nuclear threat, or is it too much to contemplate? How would a radioactive downtown affect the nation's psyche, America's economy, its will to fight? Join the conversation. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston.
From Boston University, this is...
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the threat of the dirty bomb. That is a conventional explosive, maybe even a nuclear power plant, turned into an explosive spreading radiological material, radioactive material over an area that would kill some people right away, more over time, and empty an area, be it a few blocks or our guests tonight suggest as much as an area the size of the state of Pennsylvania. We're talking with Matthew Bunn. From 1994 to 1996, he advised the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy on issues related to security and monitoring of nuclear materials. He's now at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Matthew Bunn, what's being done? There's been a lot of talk about prevention, but what's actually going on Capitol Hill right now or in the Bush administration to combat this?
Well, unfortunately, although President Bush has correctly, in my judgment, said that keeping weapons of mass destruction out of the hands of terrorists should be our highest priority, the amount of money that he has assigned to additional efforts to do that since September 11, out of the $40 billion that Congress authorized, is zero. Not a single penny. And at the moment, Senate Democrats are attempting to add several hundred million dollars to efforts to secure plutonium and highly enriched uranium and nuclear weapons in Russia, to reemploy nuclear scientists in Russia who might otherwise get desperate enough to sell the material they have access to or sell their knowledge. And unfortunately, at the moment, that's tied up in a larger game over how much are we going to bust the budget to respond to September 11, and the president is threatening to veto what I regard as very important funds for preventing very clear threats to the United States of America.
Well, pick that apart for us. It's just watching our pennies on the budget, or is there some other reason that a president who has seen the devastating effects of a terrorist attack would not find this a worthwhile investment, some practical reason?
As far as I can tell, it's mainly being penny wise and pound foolish.
How much money are we talking about?
We're talking about pennies on the dollar. If you spent less than 1% of the defense budget for only a few years on securing nuclear, chemical, biological material, you could largely resolve the problems related to security of nuclear weapons and nuclear materials and the chemical and biological equivalents.
I think we'd all prefer that to emptying Pennsylvania. We're taking calls at 1-800-423-8255, and there are a lot of people who want to join the conversation. Alan is on the line. Welcome, Alan. You're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Matt, pleasure to talk to both of you. My question is, if a dirty bomb was set off, what would be the treatment regimen for the people who are exposed to the uranium-238 or whatever it was, cesium-90, whatever they happen to use, and how quickly would this treatment have to be administered to ameliorate the effects of the radioactivity? And what would be the estimated survival rate of, say, 6 months, 1 year, 5 years, and so on?
Got it. Thank you, Alan. And Matthew Bunn, you can hear in this question, Americans calculating the same way they do with anthrax, you know, I think.
Right.
How do I respond to this? But how about it?
Exactly. In the case of the dirty bomb, very few people, if any, would actually get sick right away. They'd get such a big radiation dose that they'd get sick right away. What you'd be talking about is people getting cancer down the road.
Down the road?
10 years, 20 years, 30 years. You know, cancer is a somewhat random process. In the case of an attack, a successful attack on a nuclear power plant that really caused a major catastrophic accident or a spent fuel facility, you would be talking about a lot of people with very near-term radiation sickness, and we don't have...
More like a Hiroshima and Nagasaki
exactly,
situation.
And we don't have the sort of surge capacity to be able to treat that many people very fast in the way that we ought to. There are treatments available. They are effective, but only to a limited degree.
Medicine or drugs or
yeah,
what?
Yeah, drugs, a variety of palliative care can actually reduce the fatalities quite dramatically.
And what kind of palliative care? Does it have? Is this a drug you must take immediately, or is it something that can be done a month later? Or
It's a wide variety of things. Partly it's keeping people hydrated, making sure they drink enough. In the case of a nuclear power plant where radioiodine is one of the big issues that will lodge in people's thyroid glands, it's important to have iodine pills available so that you basically flood your system with normal iodine so the radioactive iodine doesn't get a chance to lodge in your thyroid gland. There are a variety of things one can do.
But and how about the public health response or are we ready? Are these palliative measures at hand?
I think there's a lot of training and equipment and supplies for first responders that need to be put in place. There was recently an excellent report from the National Commission on Radiation Protection and Measurement that was put out specifically on what kinds of things need to be done in the event of a terrorist radiological dispersal.
Matthew Bunn, let's take another call. Matt is on the line. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi. Great show. Very interesting topic. A question. We've talked about, I've heard you and your guests talk about the opportunity of nuclear-type dirty bombs and such. But I was thinking, what if there were like a dirty depth charge, so to speak? It would almost be invisible. You wouldn't even know what's there. If there were some type of nuclear waste dropped in some of the water resources that feed a lot of our major cities, what's the potential for that? Is there a potential... I'm not even quite sure what the effect would be of something along that line.
Matt, I'm sure you're not the only one whose imagination is working here, but help us, Matthew Bunn. And thank you for your call, Matt. Is this a realistic possibility? How broadly do we have to think about the vulnerability to our water supplies?
I think we have to think about the vulnerability of a variety of things, and I think Irene was exactly right that we need to think through very carefully, you know, what would be the best terrorist options and block each of those terrorist options in the most cost-effective way that we can. However, water supplies with radiological material, I think, is not one of the bigger worries in my mind. If you had plutonium, for example, it's very insoluble. If you dumped several kilograms of plutonium into the bus and water supply, you wouldn't even increase the dose that you and I get from the natural background radiation.
So that's not vulnerability number one.
Not to my mind, no.
Matthew Bunn, we've just got a couple of minutes. I have three more questions I want to get to, so give us some quick answers here. First, if the chase is on, if the race is on, and maybe they do have it right now, in a nutshell, what do we do? How do we track it down and get it out of their hands?
Well, I think we need to use the capabilities we have that Peter mentioned at the beginning of the hour. The search teams, what's called the nuclear emergency search team that is trained, is equipped with radiation detectors to go out and find terrorist nuclear devices. It may be that some of those capabilities should be deployed even to Afghanistan to try to find some of these things, although finding them in caves, the caves shield the radiation, so
pretty
it's
tough.
Very difficult to do. There is a lot more we need to be doing on intelligence, on figuring out where is it that nuclear material is insecure, where is it that there's radiological material that's going missing, where is it that the smuggling is taking place, and there's a lot more we can do to interdict those flows.
Last question. You've looked at this for a long time. Give us just your assessment of the psychology of dealing with the unthinkable. Are we somehow less prepared to deal with this because it's so frightening?
I think so, and I think that a lot of people had the idea that the nuclear threat went away when the Cold War went away a decade ago. Unfortunately, nothing could be further from the truth. We still have 30,000 nuclear weapons in the world. We have hundreds of tons of potential bomb material in the world. We have more than 10,000 sources for radiation in use in industry and medicine around the world. There's an enormous amount to do to deal with the nuclear threat. If anything, it's more complex, more difficult to address than it was before.
We all want to settle down and sit with our families and relax for the holidays, but the fact is we cannot afford to be blasé in any way about this.
I don't think we can, but I do think there's much that we can do, and if we act now and act decisively, I still believe we can prevent nuclear terrorism.
Matthew Bunn is Assistant Director of the Science, Technology, and Public Policy Program at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Matthew, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, rumors of war. If you iron your mail, you can kill anthrax spores. Osama bin Laden owns both Snapple and Citibank, and an unburned Bible was found amidst the charred wreckage at the Pentagon crash site. These are some of the many urban legends and rumors that have circulated in cyberspace and around America's water coolers and barbershops since September 11th. With her husband David, Barbara Mickelson sorts facts and fiction and researches the origin of these stories on a website called Snopes.com. I spoke with her recently and asked her why she finds these rumors so compelling.
Well, I think they're compelling for all of us because they give voice to any number of anxieties that we're all feeling. Telling these stories is sort of a way of sharing a number of concerns that we have about current society or events that are going on around us. And it's also sort of a way of gauging the moral temperature of the times, as in what activities are okay and what things are frowned upon.
And how do rumors give us a sense of control?
Well, one of the ways they do that is they attempt, through sort of a simplification, to reduce the unknown and unknowable down to something that could be understood and possibly controlled and dealt with. Mm-hmm. For instance, a terrorist could strike anywhere at any time. Mm-hmm. But through our rumors, we're able to sort of reduce it down to a matter of a terrorist who drops his wallet in the street is helped by a woman who runs behind, picks up the wallet, gives it back to him, and he turns around and thanks her by saying, stay out of Boston on the 23rd or stay out of New York subways on the 14th or whatever.
In this very nervous fall and in other times, how do these urban legends speak to moral issues?
Well, they speak to moral issues by basically giving voice to how we think the world should be run. In other words, what behavior should be rewarded and which ones should be punished. Patriotism is obviously very much on everyone's mind, and it's being viewed as a much more important component of American life. Thus, we're seeing anything that is perceived as an act of patriotism will be lauded in the legends that we're telling.
So what are some of the notable urban legends and internet rumors that have circulated about September 11th and the war on terror?
Well, the first one that took the internet by storm anyway was the fake Nostradamus rumor. And this was a supposed quatrain written by the 15th century seer in which it was predicted that in the city of York, something about twin brothers falling and silver birds and the beginning of the Third Great War.
So this was supposedly predicting the World Trade Center attack?
That's right. And, of course, the thing was a hoax. It had basically started off as a Canadian university student's attempt to make up a Nostradamus quatrain purely as an exercise in showing how easy it was to make an important-sounding rumor out of absolutely nothing. Then someone else found it and started playing mix and match with the various lines and sort of taking things out, adding things in, till there finally was a version circulation that sounded so darned accurate.
That people had to believe it. You're very systematic about tracking down the origins and truth or falsehood of these. I'm looking at your website, Snopes.com, and let's just look at some of these. Here, Osama bin Laden owns Citibank?
No, he doesn't.
You've tracked that down.
Now, we tracked. I think the government would do an even better job tracking it.
That would be all frozen, wouldn't it? And then there's the famous photograph of a tourist standing on top of the World Trade Center, supposedly seconds before the plane hit it, with the plane veering into it in the background. Real or artificial?
Oh, it's a complete bit of fakery. The photograph was put together by combining three different elements, and basically, it was once again likely a bit of internet humor. However, people took it very seriously. For them, it just brought back the horror of September 11th because they thought they were seeing the last half second of this man's life and the last half second of a beautiful, wonderfully normal day for all of us.
Of a lost world. And then from mid-November, a woman who had survived the destruction of the World Trade Center died on American Airlines Flight 587 just 2 months later. True or false?
It's true. It's true. There was such a woman who was working in a restaurant on the ground floor who did escape and reach safety without too much trouble. And there she was 2 months later flying home to be with family. She was on the plane that went down in Queens.
How do you go about debunking the false rumors that you've posted?
Well, sometimes it's easy simply because some of them don't have any logic to them. They couldn't possibly happen. But a lot of times it's just basically gumshoe work, calling people, looking up information, and hunting about.
And how about the volume of these urban legends and rumors since September 11th? Has it increased?
It was very, very heavy throughout October and the first half of November. Mm-hmm. Things have since tailed off a bit.
Which goes to your point that it's in a way that society's one way that society has of processing unimaginable events.
Yes, it's all part of the way we digest and come to terms with things that were unthinkable.
Barbara Mickelson and her husband David catalog and research rumors and urban legends on their website, Snopes.com. To read how the Arab satellite TV network Al Jazeera is reporting on events in Israel and Afghanistan, go to our website at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.
This is WBUR. We're funded by